This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Clark Kent Irvin, was the Department of Homeland Security's first inspector general. It was his job to inspect the department's programs and see that they were effective, conduct audits, and dispatch a team of criminal investigators to look into criminal or civil violations. In his new book, Irvin says his efforts to call attention to the gaps in our security were derided, dismissed, or ignored by the men whose job it was to close those gaps. We contacted the Department of Homeland Security and its former head, Tom Ridge, and invited them to respond to Irvin's interview. They declined. Clark Kent Irvin served in the administration of George W. Bush when he was governor of Texas. In 2001, Irvin joined the State Department as Inspector General. In 2003, President Bush gave Irvin a recess appointment as Inspector General of Homeland Security. His appointment was never confirmed by the Senate, and the president declined to renominate him. Irvin left the position after 2 years. His new memoir is called Open Target, Where America is Vulnerable to Attack. You write in your book, why are we deceiving ourselves? What do you think we're deceiving ourselves about?
The Department of Homeland Security's leaders are overstating how prepared we are for the next attempted terrorist attack. In program after program, the department touts itself as being better able to handle another terrorist attack than it in fact is. Let me give you one quick example. In the port security area, and this is important because every expert agrees that the likeliest way for a terrorist to sneak a weapon of mass destruction in this country would be through our seaports. We are inspecting only about 6% of the thousands of cargo ships that come into our ports every day. And to answer the charge that we're not doing enough, the department points to a program called the Container Security Initiative. Basically, the department has an agreement with about 40 ports around the world now, representing about 70% of the cargo that comes from abroad to the United States, whereby we station our inspectors abroad and they work with foreign inspectors to ensure that those foreign inspectors inspect cargo that we deem to be high risk. The problem is that recent reports, one as recently as just a few weeks ago, points out that only about 17.5% of the time, less than a fifth of the time, do these foreign countries with which we have these agreements actually inspect cargo that we have intelligence that leads us to believe may be high risk, may contain a weapon of mass destruction. And yet, the department touts the Container Security Initiative as the antidote to the problem of a smuggled weapon of mass destruction.
Are there other ways you think we're deceiving ourselves about how protected we are?
Take the aviation security area. We have done more, to be fair, to secure ourselves against another aviation-style attack than with regard to any other sector, and that's understandable since, of course, that was the mode that was chosen on 9/11. We've spent something between $18 to $20 billion to secure ourselves, and we're somewhat more secure. But we're not secure enough, and we're not secure as the department claims. And according to a recent congressional report out just a few weeks ago, investigators were able to smuggle bomb components undetected through 21 airports throughout the country. And yet, the department claims that we're significantly safer in terms of aviation today than we were beforehand. And indeed, there are people in the department and in department supporters who claim that another 9/11 style attack simply could not happen again. And that is not borne out by the facts, frankly.
So you ask the question, why are we deceiving ourselves? You just gave us a couple of examples of how you think we're deceiving ourselves. But let me get back to the question, why do you think we're deceiving ourselves?
Well, I think two things. First of all, I think we Americans, just as the 9/11 Commission said there was a failure of imagination before 9/11, which prevented us from really taking the threat of 9/11 seriously and doing what we could have done beforehand to avert the disaster. Similarly, there's a failure of imagination still. 9/11 was so catastrophic, it was so outside our consciousness that we Americans, subconsciously, our leadership, finds it really hard to believe, even though all the intelligence is to the contrary, that another 9/11 style attack or one even worse could happen again. So part of it is a subconscious failure to recognize just how vulnerable we remain and how determined the terrorists are to strike us again. That's part of it. Secondly, frankly, and this is more nefarious, the people at the department to this day and during the Ridge years, we're deceiving ourselves because I think they're concerned about the political implications for the department, for the administration, if the average American were to know just how vulnerable we remain.
What was the reaction that you got from Tom Ridge, who was the head of Homeland Security when you were the Inspector General, from Ridge and from other leaders in the department, each time you issued a report of problems that you and your team found?
Time and again, there was never a counterexample. The reaction from Secretary Ridge and the rest of his leadership team was either that the problems that we were pointing to did not exist, or that we were exaggerating things and making a mountain out of a molehill, or that the problem and issue had already been solved and our reports and recommendations were old news. To give you one example, we issued a number of reports about laxity in visa processes, border security matters. And I recall very vividly Secretary Ridge at one point summoning me to his office to complain about that report and asking whether I was his inspector general and questioning why I was issuing these damning reports. My response to that was that I was not his inspector general. Instead, I was the American people's inspector general, and I was issuing these reports because I had an obligation to the Congress and, most importantly, to the American people to apprise them of these vulnerabilities and gaps so that they could be aware of the danger that they're in and so that, aware of that danger, they could put the appropriate pressure on the administration and the department to do what was necessary to close these security gaps. On another occasion, when, for example, we completed our work that I alluded to earlier at airports, showing just how easy it was for guns and knives and explosives to be sneaked through the then federalized screener workforce, when I presented those results to the then head of TSA, Jim Loy, who subsequently became the deputy secretary of the department, if, for example, the report said that there was a failure rate of 40% at a given airport, he stopped me midway through the presentation and said, "Clark, why are you focusing on failure rates? Why not talk about the pass rate at that airport? It was a pass rate of 60%. And my response was, "Jim, because it doesn't matter if screeners were able to detect these deadly weapons 6 times out of 10, if they were unable to do so 4 times out of 10. 4 times out of 10 is 4 times too many in the age of terror." So rather than making bad results better, he was focused on making bad results sound better. And that was emblematic of what I found time and again at the Department of Homeland Security during my tenure.
Now, one of your concerns is the fact that we have tightened security, not enough, you think, but we have tightened security in places like airports and some buildings, that has made softer targets even more vulnerable. Because if the airports are harder to attack, if the airlines are harder to attack, then restaurants, shopping malls, apartment complexes, things like that become more enticing targets. One of your big concerns is mass transit. You say 33 million people use mass transit a day in the United States. And yet there's really very little security on mass transit. Part of the reason why there's so little security is that I think no one can figure out what to do. If we had the kind of screening that we do for airports, for buses and trains, it's hard to imagine anybody would get to where they're going in a reasonable fashion. So what do you think we could be doing to increase security on mass transit, particularly in the wake of London and Madrid?
Well, I think there are a number of things that we actually did do in response to Madrid and to London that make a lot of sense. As you say, it's hard to believe that the very same kind of intensive screening procedures that we have in airports would work in mass transit because of the nature of mass transit. It's mass transit, as the name implies. On the other hand, after Madrid and after London, we took a number of sensible steps. For example, increased police presence, greater use of bomb-sniffing dogs, greater use of surveillance cameras, bomb sensors, etc. All of these measures were instituted in the immediate aftermath of those attacks. The problem is, though, that as soon as the headlines faded and the sense of danger faded from those two attacks, those measures were all either ratcheted back dramatically or done away with altogether. The problem with that is that terrorists are adaptive and they're flexible and they are alert. They know that we relaxed those measures, and so I'm sure they would simply wait until those measures are relaxed or done away with before attempting attack on mass transit. So what we need to do is to institutionalize those measures, to have those measures part of mass transit security on an ongoing basis, not just episodically when there appears to be a threat.
As a conservative Republican, I would assume that you're opposed to tax increases. Perhaps I'm wrong about that. But I'm wondering if your thinking about taxes changed at all, wanting more money for the Department of Homeland Security and watching the president cut taxes at the same time.
Well, certainly, as you say, I'm a conservative Republican, but I try very hard not to let my ideology interfere with experience. And I think the experience of the last few years with our very, very dire fiscal straits should lead any reasonable person to conclude that we've got to change our fiscal policies. I think that tax increases should always be a matter of last resort. I think there's an alternative to tax increases, and if it were up to me, I would, as I say, divert some of the money from the defense budget to the Department of Homeland Security. I would also, if necessary, and I'm afraid that it would be necessary, forego making the tax cuts that have already been passed permanent. That would save us billions of dollars that could go to protect the homeland and make us measurably safer.
A Senate report on the government's response to Katrina recommends doing away with FEMA and creating a new department, which would be called the National Preparedness and Response Authority. And this new agency would take on some additional responsibilities, and it would still be in the Homeland Security Department. And the budget for this new agency would be doubled. Do you think that that's the right solution to FEMA's problems?
Well, I think it's another example of what Washington always does when there is a significant political problem, and that is it proposes changes to the organization chart as opposed to actually solving the underlying problem. I don't think that creating a new agency with a new name will in and of itself make the problems of FEMA go away. The problem of FEMA, in a nutshell, is that it has been underfunded like the rest of the department. It has lacked expert leadership like the rest of the department. And it has had a culture that has not welcomed outside scrutiny and criticism such that there would be concentration on solving the problems that there are. And if there were a new organization with a new name and, again, the same budget and the same leadership and the same culture, you'd have exactly the same result the next time there's a catastrophe, whether it's a man-made catastrophe or a natural one. The only thing in the Senate report, the Senate proposal that makes sense is doubling the budget of FEMA. I wouldn't wed myself to a particular figure, but as I say, FEMA needs more money. But the last thing that it needs is another reorganization. We need to take the government that we have, and we need to give that government the resources it needs and the leadership it needs and the culture it needs, and we need to make the government work.
You write that a lot of the most critical infrastructure is owned and operated by the private sector, and the government has been reluctant to use its power to mandate security enhancements in the private sector. Can you give us an example of parts of the critical infrastructure that are actually owned and operated by the private sector?
Absolutely. In fact, about 85% of critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector here in this country. And that distinguishes us from much of the rest of the world, where so many of these sectors and sites are either owned or operated or both by the government. And it's actually generally a good thing. It's been a key factor in our economic primacy in the world. But virtually every one of these sectors that's significant is in private hands. You know, take the food sector, chemical refineries and other elements of our energy sector, which, of course, are so much in the news today with gas prices, the electricity grid, so many of the nuclear facilities are actually run by private entities as well. And so it's difficult because there has generally been a reluctance in our country to use the power of regulation and legislation to require the private sector to do what the private sector otherwise would not do, and that's especially true for a conservative administration and a conservative Congress. And here we are nearly 5 years after 9/11, and the evidence is in now, and it's pretty clear to me and to other experts, I think it's fair to say, that the private sector has not done what it needs to do to secure itself to the maximum possible degree. There's one bit of good news, and that is in the chemical sector. There are so many chemical plants that, in fact, EPA estimated that there are around 100 chemical plants in the country concentrated largely along the Northeast Corridor, New York, New Jersey, that if they were hit in just the right way could result in millions of casualties. Because of the uniquely dangerous nature of these chemical facilities, a consensus is emerging that includes industry, and the department's embraced it now, that there does need to be regulation in the chemical sector. Now, Secretary Chertoff announced a measure just a few weeks ago that, to my mind, is more watered down and more accommodating to industry than it should be. But at least there's a recognition that something should be done in terms of regulation in this sector. The problem is the chemical sector is not the only sector where there has been less progress than there should be, because these are not just private assets. An attack against one of them would be so devastating to the overall economy of the country that each of them is, by definition, critically important to the security of the country as well.
Let me get back to something we were talking about earlier. So you've criticized the leadership of Homeland Security for not being qualified enough, and I'm wondering if you think that Michael Chertoff is worthy of that kind of criticism, too. What do you think of the job he's been doing and of his qualifications?
I'm afraid to say that that criticism, in my judgment, is equally applicable to Secretary Chertoff as well. I thought I was cheered by his nomination, by his appointment, his confirmation. I thought that he would be a huge improvement over Secretary Reid. Certainly he's a different person, a radically different person. He's incredibly bright, razor-sharp mind. He's very, very details-oriented. He's hands-on. He's decisive, all qualities that seems to me, frankly, were lacking to one degree or another in the prior regime. But the first big test for Secretary Chertoff was, of course, Katrina, and it's plain for all the world to see that he failed that test. And I think what it shows is that he, too, lacks managerial experience, and that running the criminal division of the Justice Department is impressive, needless to say, but it is not training, is not adequate preparation for running the third largest agency in the federal government with 180,000 employees and a $40 billion budget, and not just a big agency, but an incredibly complex one with, as I say, the most important mission in government. Running the Department of Homeland Security effectively would test the managerial skills of a Jack Welch or Lee Iacocca. And on top of that, you would need ideally someone who has phenomenal political skills as well. It's a rare person who has both those abilities, but Secretary Chertoff, I'm afraid to say, has manifestly proved not to be up to the task as well.
You know, the Bush administration has said that we're winning the war on terror, and an example that it has offered is that there hasn't been a terrorist attack on our land since September 11th. Do you think that that is evidence that we're winning the war on terror?
I don't think that it's evidence that we're winning the war on terror. And in fact, I think it's dangerous for the department, for the administration to say that or to imply that, to think that simply because we now have a department called Homeland Security, that the homeland is secure, is dangerous. It's misleading. It makes us think that we're safer than we actually are. If anything, of course, needless to say, the fact that we haven't been attacked in 5 years, nearly 5 years, of course, is a good thing. But on the other hand, all the intelligence indicates that the reason why we haven't been attacked is not because we've made ourselves marginally more secure since 9/11, but instead because Al-Qaeda and its affiliates and acolytes wants the next attack to be even more spectacular than the last one. And it takes time to plan these spectacular attacks. And so everything we know leads to the conclusion that another terrorist attack will be attempted. The only question is whether we've done everything that we can do to make ourselves as safe as we possibly can.
Clark Kent Irvin, before we let you go, I've got to ask you how you got the Clark Kent part of your name and what impact that's had on you to have that name follow you around.
I have two brothers, both older than I. One was about 11 or so when I was born, and when he found out that my parents were to have a baby boy, he asked whether he could name me, and they said yes, and the result was being named after my brother's favorite comic book hero, Superman.
Do you think your parents ever considered saying to your older brother, son, we can't really name your baby brother Clark Kent?
Well, of course, I was not privy to those conversations back then, but from everything I've been told since, my parents did not hesitate. So it just shows that they have quite a sense of humor themselves.
Well, Clark Kent Irvin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Clark Kent Irvin was the Department of Homeland Security's first Inspector General. His new book is called Open Target. We invited the Department of Homeland Security to respond to Irvin's book or interview. Press Secretary Russ Kanaki declined. He said they've not seen or read the book, but any suggestion that there was an effort to stifle the inspector general is fundamentally flawed. He added that Irvin is entitled to his opinion. He can make claims, but they're not necessarily based on fact. We also contacted the office of Tom Ridge, the former secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. He declined our invitation and had not heard Clark Irvin's interview on Fresh Air, but he offered this statement, quote, "Mr. Irvin's recall of events is wrong. I thought our discussions were civil and professional. In an earlier interview, Mr. Irvin told CNN that I never asked him not to release critical reports. Later, he changed his story. Mr. Irvin's first recollection is accurate. This one is not. I never sought to keep any reports from Congress. The allegation is simply untrue." Unquote.